Welcome to this episode of Real Space Strategy. I'm your host, Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Deterrence and Warfighting at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies in Washington, D.C. Real Space Strategy exists to provide you, the listener, a reality check on U.S. space policy and strategy, while giving you insight into the processes required to achieve a credible deterrent and warfighting posture for the United States Space Force. The views expressed by the host and guests in Real Space Strategy are those of the host and guests and are not to be attributed or considered part of any government entity or private sector company. In the past few weeks, we have seen the rollout of the Space Warfighting Framework document and a new C-note by the U.S. Space Force. Both documents claim to be a next step towards getting the service away from its terrestrial support roots in the Air Force, or at least that by itself, and towards its established mission of gaining and maintaining space superiority, providing deterrence against space attack upon our nation's critical space infrastructure, and preserving freedom of action in orbital and cislunar space. The words in the warfighting document, for example, are better than recent official documents, but still creates confusion among its readers, as does the recent speeches and commentary by several of the Space Force's senior leadership. So, first the good things. It is nice to finally see them using terms in public like space warfighting, offense, defense, and space superiority. They rightly state that space superiority is the main mission of the service and correctly state, obviously, that space warfare is a human activity. However, the messaging in the document, as I mentioned, is confusing and conflicting. First off is its cover. For a document that speaks of space warfighting, it's interesting that the cover only shows a GPS satellite, an outdated block version, interestingly enough, and a far-off space launch. This hardly exudes an image of a space warfighting or robust presence in space. Now, I know some of you might be saying it's just a cover, big deal. However, in strategic communications, it's very important to use all avenues of communications, even imagery, to evoke the key points of the document so that it sticks in the minds of friends and foes alike. Second, while they speak of threats in the space domain, and I will mention this later, but I prefer the phrase space AOR or area responsibility because that's what it is. So again, when they speak of threats in the space AOR and speak about offensive and defensive operations, it does not mention space deterrence. But like many of their public comments and planning statements, still are connected to terrestrial services, that it appears that warfighting really means warfighting support and not space warfighting at all. It means enabling other terrestrial types of superiority in the air, on land, and sea, and not space. A case in point, recently Lieutenant General Bratton, Deputy Chief of Space Operations for Strategy, Plans, Programs, and Requirements, that is quite a long title, the person who is responsible for generating the requirements needed to push acquisition of weapons necessary to achieve space superiority was quoted as follows, quote, "We need to think about terrestrial fires and demand signal." Golden Dome does open a new area as we think about this boost phase intercept from space. I don't think we're going further than that at this time on thinking about any specific capabilities, but it really just needs to remind planners, don't lock yourself into just the space domain. Sometimes the best way to solve the threat or defeat the threat that you're facing within the space domain is to solve that problem in the terrestrial domain, end quote. So a few thoughts on this. First, he said that the Space Force is not developing anything for in-space defense or in-space attack to defend space attack approaches to the homeland or space infrastructure other than the space-based interceptors for Golden Dome, which is an odd thing to do to limit yourself publicly like that when there are so many needs for in-space and space-to-ground weapons systems, kinetic and non-kinetic, not to mention the severe lack of numbers of the systems we do have. Now, I do want to pause for a second and state that I give credit to the Chief of Space Operations, General Saltzman, for mentioning that we do lack the numbers of electromagnetic warfare jammer systems like CCS and Bounty Hunter. He said this in public testimony last month, and I give him credit for that. If you are going to gain, much less maintain space superiority, localized or broadly, you cannot limit yourself to what others tell you to do. You are supposed to be the requirements generator in partnership with U.S. Space Command, and yet you aren't pushing for the weapons to address the threat in space? Makes no sense to me. Second, you see that his quote, and many Space Force leaders do this, that they pivot from talking about how they are going to get after space superiority, but then they say that others are the ones who should provide the threat, disruption, or destruction, not the Space Force. He said to remind you all, meaning planners, don't lock yourself into just the space domain. Sometimes the best way to solve the threat or defeat the threat that you are facing within the space domain is to solve that problem in the terrestrial domain. Now, I totally get that there are some ground-based threats like ASAT missiles, ground-based lasers, and electromagnetic jammers that could be taken care of through supporting fires from terrestrial services like the air, land, and sea forces. However, that does not meet the requirement that Space Force is a military service and lacks the capabilities to conduct independent combat operations of its own, including prosecuting terrestrial threats from space or in-space threats from the domain by itself. Can you imagine a chief of staff of the Air Force say, the best way air planners can solve air threats or defeat threats in the air is to rely on the Army and Navy to take care of you? Or a chief of naval operations say, the object of the Navy is to support the Army and the Air Force. We must rely on the Air Force to protect the sea lanes of communications and our fleet. No, you wouldn't. In fact, I will give you an example. A few years ago, when I was working in a consulting position, I was asked to call around the different services and say, hey, what would you think about moving certain assets over to a space service? And when I got to the Navy and all the Army and the other people, they basically answered, not over my dead body. So, no, you wouldn't see that. But again, you see a lot of jointness in this document, and joint planning of using all resources is good. But too many times does the Space Force continually punt the responsibility to equip their own service to be armed and capable of independent operations like the other services. While we fight jointly, Space Force must be able to address its own domain, or AOR, as it is not the job of the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines, or Coast Guard to deter space attacks or win wars in the space AOR. One other item of interest in the framework that I note missing is the phrase space deterrence. Now, the word deterrence is mentioned a few times, but again, it's space support to general deterrence, and that's only discussed very briefly. Space is not seen as a separate AOR in this document, distinct from the Earth itself, and in need of a force of sufficient size to preserve freedom of access and operations in orbital and cislunar space. This is a big gap in thinking and will continue to negatively impact Space Force requirements and planning unless this terrestrial support mentality is erased as the prominent view. The adversary, China in particular, does not simply see space systems and capabilities as a terrestrial enabler, but space is a battlefield and an AOR of its own, distinct from the Earth. They have been building a robust in-space force of weapon systems for proactive attack to deter, type models of operations, what they call their multi-layered attack architecture, ready and willing to prosecute a, quote, rapid and destructive space war against the United States and its allies. They have a holistic connective tissue with terrestrial operations, but they are building a true space force capable of kinetic operations in space, as well as space-to-ground strikes. Yet when discussing the, quote, threat from China, General Saltzman's recent comments focus not on the space deterrence and warfighting capabilities in and from the space domain that we seek, but rather he focuses on what he calls tongue-in-cheek. I don't know why he uses that phrase. It usually means he's joking. But he calls it tongue-in-cheek, a kill web, and it's nothing more than a series of hundreds of satellites that are a sensor network that provide real-time updates targeting quality information on our terrestrial force. We have to build our capabilities to try and disrupt that, so when they're trying to achieve military objectives, our soldiers, sailors, and airmen are safe and not under this umbrella of a very accurate, very long-range set of weapons. End quote. Really, I think it's more than just a sensor network that we have to worry about. The Chinese have said that they have been building for years a quantum satellite computing capability that is able to process targeting of both terrestrial targets, yes, but also critical space infrastructure in orbit and spacecraft access beyond that. I mean, I'll remind you of previous episodes where I've talked about numerous Chinese papers, credible papers, and plans and leaders stating that they want to, quote, kill Starlink and any other types of low Earth orbit a resilient space architecture, not just those supporting ground operations. Space superiority to them means you have the ability to prevent others from achieving their objectives in the space AOR, not that you can support terrestrial fires. They do that, but that is not the same thing. They are connected, but one is the mission of the service, space superiority. The other is a byproduct that comes from achieving space superiority and deterrence. An important byproduct, to be sure, but not the so what of the service, planning, acquisition, and operational activities in and from space. So back to the service framework. As a service framework, it's still too focused on joint terrestrial support, despite saying that space is more than support functions. It's very odd. It says that, and then it goes into talking all about space support functions. Space Force documents should, ideally, be focused on gaining and sustaining deterrence of attack or winning space war fighting through space superiority and strategic effects related to that. So I'm going to give you a few examples of some things that were said in the framework, and I'll just provide a little bit of comment on what I think would have been better. So first example, you don't need to say, quote, Space Force capabilities are critical to the joint force and the American way of life. It's too focused on support activities for terrestrial operations, and they keep saying joint force too many times. It would be better and more accurate to say space power, another word they don't use, is vital to the American way of life, period. Space power is inherently strategic as it directly connects to all instruments of national power, and as such can negatively or positively impact the success of national strategy, not just military strategy or operations. All of this is impacting at the national security strategy level and above simply supporting the so-called joint force. Another example, terminology. While better, still needs work. Most of the terms used are too broad or not broad enough. It's very strange. You can't seem to find a happy medium anywhere. For example, the term space power, as I mentioned earlier, is not used at all. They say space operations are multi-domain. Another one of my pet peeves. Space operations are not multi-domain. Multi-domain, for those of you that may not be sure what I'm talking about, is essentially what they were arguing earlier. If you want to take care of a space threat, call on somebody in another domain, air, land, sea, or even cyber, and they'll take care of it for you. Or that it impacts all domains, and that's true. But that doesn't mean that space operations are multi-domain. They're really not. I could argue that they're multi-segment, because there's a space segment, a ground segment, an electromagnetic segment that's used to transmit and receive data and telemetry and commands and such from the spacecraft to the ground headquarters or mission control site. Multi-domain is just an excuse for the Space Force to not request the budget necessary for arming the service as it should be for its Title 10 responsibility by pulling from other service resources. For example, air defense artillery is not air power, and it's not air combat operations. I don't think the Air Force would call it that. Such capabilities do not gain air superiority, but it can make an adversary's attempt to achieve air superiority more challenging and harder to attack and destroy critical terrestrial infrastructure. Ground-based anti-satellites, missiles, lasers, etc. are not space power and should not be considered part of that. Space defense, as it probably should be called more often than not counter space, can be based and operate in the air, land, sea, or cyber domains. Another example, as mentioned earlier, space deterrence still not being used as a doctrinal term. It's mostly just talking about space generically and being described as supporting U.S. deterrence efforts. So it's talking about general deterrence again, which is thinking more about stuff that's true. I mean, again, it's true. Space-based warning and tracking, communications, all that. That's all important. But not including space deterrence leaves out a major chunk of the space superiority space operations arena that the Space Force should be focused on. The recently crafted space superiority definition seen in other documents put out by the Space Force also has too many caveats and should refrain from using old terms such as counter space. That's like summarizing air operations by air and counter air or sea and counter sea. There's way more to it than that. And that says essentially nothing that a planner or strategist can use. Space superiority does not include protecting friendly forces in all domains, quote unquote, as they say in this document, although the second and third order impact will do such things. In other words, space-to-ground strikes on land, air, or maritime forces could be helpful. Taking out a spacecraft of the adversary might help them not be spotted and give them the ability to get to their sea or air or land-based locations less, but, you know, better and more often, but it's not the case. It's not the objective. It's not the end of space superiority. Air superiority, as another example, is not accomplished in order to protect ground forces, but to gain control of the air and accomplish aerial, strategic, or tactical operational objectives and tasks. It prevents the enemy from doing their own things that include terrestrial strike, but the objective is to control the air. Space is similar. Maritime superiority, as another example, is closer to space superiority, and the fact they have used Corbett in this document, who was very well connected to land theory, was likely on purpose. Frankly, I think they should have used Mahan, or at least a mix of that. Number four, seizing space superiority, this is a quote from the document, seizing space superiority at the time in place of our choosing can offer advantages to military forces. Again, talking terrestrial stuff. By concentrating effects to control celestial lines of communication, United States Space Forces can achieve space superiority and enable joint lethality. In many ways, the modern use of various orbital regimes in the space domain provides similar advantages to military forces that control key terrain and positions in other domains. This was so close. This almost was a good statement. There's no mentioning in here of war winning through and by space power. Everything is, again, in support of the joint force. The Space Force is part of that nebulous joint force, by the way. It seems like every time that they talk about the joint force, it's as if Space Force is some outside entity that's supporting the joint force. But it's really, it's a military service. It's part of the joint force. So they really shouldn't use that phrase. Winning competition or war is nowhere in this document. The word winning is nowhere in this document, which is also very disappointing. Some other items that would really be good to explore, and we will in the May 2025 edition of Real Space Strategy Live, which is going to come out a few days after the recording of this podcast, is the use of quotes from Colin S. Gray, the great 20th and early 21st century strategic thinker from England, and Julian Corbett, the maritime theorist from Great Britain in the 19th century. So tune in for that discussion. However, I will say that I don't think that the use of Corbett was just because it was a nice quote. I think that's because Corbett is a land-focused sea power theorist. Everything about the maritime operations in Corbett relates back to land in his theory. Other theorists in sea power, like Mahan, other theorists in sea power like Mahan are different. So, there's so much to discuss on this, and I probably will come back to it because there's a lot more just to say. But I am happy that this document and the other documents recently coming out, as we discussed in another podcast, show a shift in their rhetoric from simply resilience and passivity, but to warfighting. However, it appears from other quotes and statements by key leaders that this rhetoric has yet to sink into the minds and requirements of the service to shift from a terrestrial support mentality to one that sees space power and space, the AOR, as the key war-winning and war-preventing area, one that our adversary is rapidly building armed forces in orbit and beyond to take out our critical space infrastructure necessary for our way of life and economic well-being, not just so-called joint force. So there is much work to be done on this. I am hopeful that with the new Secretary of the Air Force now taking his seat in the Pentagon, that we can finally get the other shoe to drop and begin the process of equipping the Space Force for war and not just helping the other services do their terrestrial jobs. Given that Dr. Mink has a pretty broad space background, I'm crossing my fingers about that. So again, there's much more to say about this, but we're now out of time. And regardless of the time, the conversation and debate is just beginning on this and other documents. So for now, this is Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks very much for listening. You've been listening to Real Space Strategy. Real Space Strategy with Christopher Stone is a production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And for more information, see us at our website, thinkdeterrence.com. That's thinkdeterrence.com, our YouTube page, and any of our various social media sites on whichever platform you choose.
The Miz Podcasting Network.